Welcome, boys and girls. Hello to all our friends and supporters. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and this is Red Ice Radio. I hope you had a good weekend. We spent hours in nature, away from computers, emails, and live shows. So with the newly charged batteries, we are ready for a new lineup of radio shows this coming month and the coming live streams that we have planned out for November. It's going to be busy. We have Weekend Warrior on November 5th, then Election Night, our marathon coverage on November 8th. We have potential coverage of the Nordic Resistance Movement in Stockholm on November 12th, but that's not set yet. And then we have NPI coverage on November 19th. So it's going to be busy, and this is just extra stuff beyond the regular radio shows and weekend live shows. So anyway, it'll be a good month, a lot of coverage. Do stay tuned to redice.tv for all of it, and also subscribe to our channel at youtube.com/redice radio. The guest we have lined up for today's show is Ryan Laundry. He is a Midwestern family man born and raised in New England. When not working in the financial realm, he maintains the blog 28 Sherman and writes every Sunday at Social Matter. He also has a podcast called Wimerica Weekly. And our theme today is going to be the striking similarities between America and the German Weimar Republic. Ryan has said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And ironically, many of the things modern liberals consider to be so-called progressive ideas, such as bizarre sexual fetishes, were actually commonplace in Weimar Germany nearly a century ago. This is a good show where we talk a bit about NRX as well, the neo-reactionary movement. Stay tuned. Ryan, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming on with us. Great to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to talking more about your show, some of the points in terms of NRX or neo-reactionary, maybe how they differ and compare with some of the alt-right ideas. We've been into the alt-right for some time now. We haven't really talked about the neo-reactionary movement that much, to be honest. But before we get into those details, tell us a bit about Wimerica Weekly, your show, how it got started, and kind of how you ended up on this page.
What ended up happening is I've been blogging for years and then focused at my home blog, 28 Sherman. And then I had focused more on political, social, cultural commentary. And what ended up happening is right around that time that in America, the great big brouhaha over gay marriage, when that really got solidified in the 2012 zone, I was disgusted not from what happened as much as the celebration and the fraud. Oh, this is new and we're so enlightened. And I had taken some history courses, some European history courses, and then some specifically on Germany. And I remember talks of the Weimar era in Germany. And so I started to look into Weimar Germany, that period, and then what America and Western Europe is going through today. And I started to see more and more similarities. And it wasn't just from, say, the odd sexual culture that was out there, but some of the social concerns, economic concerns, financial issues, power dynamics. And that's when I kind of started looking at, okay, coming up with a cute name was a reader of mine named Flavia said, well, you could just call it Wimerica. And so I created an essay where I focused mostly on just the odd sexual deviancies and just how freewheeling Weimar Germany was. And this was all, 90 years before now. And yet, people in Massachusetts in 2012 are considering themselves like the most evolved and the highest peak of progress. Yet this was already done 90 years earlier in Germany. And I wrote that, and then I started looking and kind of would do these follow-up posts when I could see, say, media coordination about a topic. And it might be that they dipped their toe in talking about bestiality or incest, or and New York Magazine, it seemed like every other month was touching a subject that was very weird, like bestiality, where a man was having sex with horses, and he freely admitted it. And they portrayed him in a neutral site. They did another one where they talked about a woman who had a relationship with her biological father. And what I noticed was that the media was running different articles about the same topic in a month. And so I would start saying, Tales from Wimerica, bestiality is cool or incest is okay. And then I approached the folks at Social Matter who were running columns of mine. And last fall I had done a podcast interview with Kevin Grace, and he kind of inspired me. And I said, hey, you know, Social Matter would be okay if I did just, you know, a 30-minute segment of just the weird stuff that's in America and call it Wimerica Weekly. And Social Matter agreed, and they've been gracious hosts. And I think I've had a couple weeks where I've had to take weeks off, but generally I've done 40-something shows where each week I try to talk about a little piece of America's either social fabric, some odd thing in the culture, or I might even talk about economics or different policies and how they're a bit weird and strange. Let's talk about it. And then I often try to tie it back to the Weimar era to say, this is not the first time. History doesn't repeat itself, but oftentimes it rhymes. So that's really where I'm at now.
Exactly. Well, it's interesting. We'll definitely get into this more in detail here as we go. But one of the things, of course, that you mentioned is the, you know, they're beginning to normalize certain things, which has been, you know, definitely unacceptable previously in our culture. I remember just actually yesterday, I was reading an article out of the New York Times. They were talking about these Satanists, right? And they called it, the headline to the story was "A Mischievous Thorn in the Side of Conservative Christianity," right? And they, Salon.com has done articles about basically trying to show the human side of a pedophile. I think the headline was like, "I'm a pedophile, yes, but not a monster," right? So we're seeing a treatment of these, you know, very, very, you know, previously unacceptable areas that are coming like more and more into the mainstream. And what's interesting is what you said, they actually get a fair treatment in the mainstream media, as opposed to, let's say, a conservative, someone in the alt-right, or God forbid, what about a white nationalist, right? That's an area where, of course, we never get any airplay of objectivity, right?
Yeah, and your mentioning of the pedophile one is interesting because that Salon chose a specific pedophile that if they had just looked into his background of different forums that he posted at, the cleaned, completely whitewashed version of how he portrayed himself did not match at all with what he said on other forums. On other forums, he was very open about, oh, I really love hugging children. And I like to be a helper at school so I can hug more kids. And he was very open about that. Yet when he was running for Salon, it was, I don't do these things. I just like being nice to children. And I've noticed that the media has chosen to portray pedophiles in the most whitewashed manner of, they try to find these guys who say, I'm a virtuous pedophile. I would never touch a child. I just think about it. And, you know, that's just not believable. And for different societies who, you know, I would say somebody knows either through, you know, through their social circle or through, you know, a friend of a friend. You might have heard of somebody who was molested as a child or sexually assaulted as a teen by an adult. You know, you're going to know that. You're going to hear, you know, the residue of that 15, 20, 30 years later, those people still carry what happened with them. You know, there's nothing about, oh, you know, I didn't mean it. You know, so that's a lie. And the fair treatment in the media, you can kind of see where it goes back to about 35, 40 years ago when they started talking about homosexuals in the 70s after the Stonewall incident. There was the whole, well, you know what, let's let them come out of the shadows. They're good people too. And it was a similar, let's just take it step by step. And I mean, we've seen this game before. And I think people, especially on the right, are very upset that they can already see them laying down the groundwork to do it with other groups.
Yeah, exactly. The tippy-toe tactic, right? You have a gradual transformation over time of culture. Yes. And now we're so deep in the cesspool of so many, you know, disgusting things that frankly should be unacceptable. And previously they have remained unacceptable to kind of keep the culture on a level of fitness, right? I mean, this is previously why you had people, for example, you know, maybe feel an innate disgust over a certain behavior or even trying to shame you or certain things because, you know, whether we admit it or not or whatever, but we have an innate drive to have our own group to be fit, right? Everyone's fitness is depending on our own survival to a certain extent. So if you had a deviant behavior or something that would even threaten the security of the group, that would be immediately pushed to the side and ostracized. But now they've managed to get up to such a point where people think, you know, that the lowest, you know, denominators of society are actually the best ones. And we're actually lifting those up to be, you know, those are the shining bright stars of examples in our society, right?
Yeah, I've referred to that in America as a negative society, like a photo negative, is that we take the trashiest elements and we raise them up on a pedestal, and then we take what's normal and previously virtuous, and we call that, you know, abnormal and weak and lame and stale. The transformation with homosexuals, the additional thing that they get that blows my mind is that at the time that that movement of accepting them, and not just accepting them, but glorifying them, at the same time that that happened, there was the threat of HIV/AIDS, which in the West started with the homosexual community, and then through blood donations, and then just, you know, bisexual men crossed over to the straight community. And, you know, if you know a hemophiliac, the hemophiliac community went through a holocaust of their own in the late 80s and early 90s because of tainted blood from gay donors and also Haitian donors down in Florida. But, you know, this whole time they spread a life-altering and a disease that was a death sentence. They spread that disease through greater society, wider society. Yet they actually saw their status improve and their protections, not just rights, their protections improved. It's just kind of mind-blowing when you look at it.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, now it's like, what is it? There's discussions of if you do discriminate against them, or it's considered, I should say, discrimination if you turn someone down, right, that have AIDS or something like that.
It's like, you know that there are different advocates who work at removing disclosure laws. And disclosure laws are where if you have HIV, you have to disclose it to a sexual partner that you have it. And there are activists and there are legal academics who will fight for the right of HIV-infected people to not have to tell somebody they're going to have sex with that I have HIV. And I mean, it's mind-blowing with them because gays could stop HIV if they all just used condoms. But once again, gay privilege means not having to wear condoms. And right now, there's PrEP or Truvada. There are these pills that gays take before they have sex that will reduce the chance of transmitting and catching HIV in sex so that gays can have condomless sex. So they take an expensive pill that research and development goes into. Everybody's insurance pays for that. So your insurance pays for them to take a pill just so that they can have, you know, bareback sex instead of wearing a condom and taking proper precautions. I was a child of the 80s. You know, I remember my 80s health classes where they would tell us little white kids in a rural school, you too can get HIV if you don't wear a condom, you know, and they scared us for 5 or 6 years.
Yep. Yeah, that's true. I mean, wasn't there like a consideration that it was actually discrimination because there wasn't yet a vaccine against AIDS or something like that, right?
It's like, yeah, and because they have their tremendous links with Hollywood and the media, gays get to retcon the 80s. And that's something I wrote about in my own personal blog. I said hidden histories, fighting bathhouse closures. And they try to retcon it that in the 80s, you know, like Reagan didn't care and Americans turned their backs as gays were dying left and right. And if you go back and look at individual cities' newspapers and what individual cities in America tried to do, there were plenty of city public health commissioners who said, let's close the bathhouses. We know that that's a vector for HIV. Well, they didn't even call it HIV at the time. They said, we know it's a vector for this gay cancer that's going around. And, you know, we should close these. And the gays fought it tooth and nail. They said, do not close down our bathhouses. That's discrimination. And like there was at one point in 1984 where they said like there was only 500 gays who had caught HIV or AIDS so far. And it's like, wow, it was that small at one point in time. And we could have just quarantined them and stopped it. But nope, we couldn't do that. And if you look at different newspapers like LA, New York, they tried to close bathhouses. And it wasn't like 1982 where nobody knew what this was. Even 86, 87, 88, right. You had bathhouses that knew what was going on. And they would say, no, we're not closing. And no, you're not going to close us. So like, you know, 10 years into the epidemic, they're still saying, forget it. Like, we really don't care. And it's amazing how they can retcon it and pretend like they were all angels and it was just Reagan. And it was just, oh, evil Christians didn't want to help them out. And it's like, no, people did. You know, you guys just didn't want to stop having fun.
Well, I think it also serves a larger purpose, which is to kind of, you know, kind of continue this the victim mentality within society, right? That they can point out these types of examples, see what they do, see what these right wingers did. This is the society that they've created, and because of that, many people, of course, have stepped back. They haven't been vocal, maybe speaking up or trying to stop certain things. So this has really been a slippery slope in many ways. And now, really, in my, as far as I'm concerned, we're circling the drain, both morally, but also in terms of, you know, where our civilization is at this moment. Let's talk a bit about, you know, some of the differences between Weimar Germany and how you see, you know, kind of America today. I think I heard you in one of your shows or podcasts, and you talked about you were looking at one book specifically that had images and pictures and stuff like that too of this period in Germany, and you said like, you were bracing yourself a little bit to, you know, what it was going to be. But because of the very fact that we are so far ahead, we've caught up to a certain extent, or America has caught up, that it wasn't that shocking maybe as you expected it to be, right?
Yeah, there's a collection, the book, it's not on the top of my, not on the tip of my tongue right now, the top of my head, but there's a book where somebody collected all of, a lot of photos, a lot of advertisements, a lot of things here and there from the Weimar period in Germany. And it was like, oh, this is wild and shocking. And I thought, and this was like 2013 or so that I saw this book. And I kind of braced myself for, okay, I'm going to see some really disturbing stuff. And when I went through it, I said, oh, wow, okay. You know, I can see how this would be shocking for even as close as the 1990s. But I'm like, nope, I've seen far worse on Tumblr and the internet. And the thing that I'd say with America and what's going on in Why America is they had their perversions back then, and in Germany there were 17 or so different types of prostitutes, the categorizations, if you will, and some were part-timers, some were foreign girls, some were dominatrix style, some were more on the masochist style, and you had to kind of be screened before they'd let you in with one. You know, there were girls who were underage, and there were so many proprietors of underage prostitutes, they actually had two different names for them, because it was like, you know, the younger teens and then like the really young, and that's disturbing. But the Weimar era had these things, and they had the cross-dressers and, you know, the men who went in as women who went as men. And I always like to mention that Marlene Dietrich and her whole shtick of kind of, you know, wearing the vests and looking kind of sexy wearing her pants, she stole her look from this short, ugly lesbian who had a radio show in Berlin. And Dietrich just said, no, that kind of is a cool look. And she kind of had the body for it. And she goes, hey, I'll do that and put my own spin on it and, you know, shot up to fame. When you look at that Weimar stuff, it would be shocking for that era, especially if you had grandparents, you know, who were young in the 20s and 30s. It would be shocking. But then when you take a look at America and what's going on in what I call White America, is we're a little bit further on in our phase of decadence, where we don't just do things, but we take things to the absolute nth degree, because we're just so straining to do something, to feel a rush. Whereas in Germany, those things were a bit new. Magnus Hirschfeld had changed the idea that, you know, it wasn't just sodomy that a man was engaged in, but that it was actually a homosexual identity. And there was these sexologists who brought this stuff up in Weimar Germany, and they had a sexual studies institute. But there were people who were more experimenting, where when you look at in America, they have just totally turned it into an identity. It doesn't just become something that you engage in on the side. Like, you know, you and your girlfriend, you just don't spank her or paddle her a couple times. It becomes an entire ritual. It becomes an identity. And after a while, that loses its zest, and you're going to have to go to a crazier level.
Exactly.
I make the joke that, like, you know, yes, there was lesbianism in Weimar Germany. And yes, there were women who dressed as men, but they did not take the scientific step of, let me save up money for top surgery. Now, do you know what top surgery is?
No.
Okay. Top surgery is when a woman has her breast removed, and by choice. And I mean, there are women who will set up, you know, Kickstarters and GoFundMes, and they'll set up charities for themselves to get top surgery. So you're not just a lesbian. You're now being a lesbian who's going to LARP and role play as a man. Right. You know, we can't just have it where we cross-dress. We now have to then take the hormones and go the whole route and pretend, not just pretend that we're going to be a man. We're going to change to be a man. Or if you're a man, you're going to change over and completely become a woman. You know, take the hormones, not just be a transvestite, but totally move over to be a transsexual. So that also becomes not just an identity thing, but it also becomes then a political thing because it fits the progressives who want to be able to break down. You know, they want to say that gender is a social construct. So they want to be able to break that down and say, oh, look, see, anybody can change. And, you know, it's just in your mind.
It's amazing.
And they're disregarding that, like, yeah, it's just in your mind, but then you have to jack your body up with, you know,
right.
3 to 5 years worth of hormones just to switch over.
Right, right. But there's no such thing, right, as biological gender. It doesn't exist. No, but no. Somehow we have to have this huge medical, like, intervention and transformation for it to work, right? So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's retarded. And then, as you said, I mean, there's a glorification of this out of Hollywood, certainly. I actually watched recently. We're gonna do a review on it, where we were meant to do a review. Don't know if you saw it, but The Danish Girl was apparently about the first, sex change. I guess it was. Let me see if I can find the year when that was. I think it was, you know, as obvious as the title implies, it was a Danish guy who you know wanted to become a girl or whatever. But it was like I think the film begins in 1926. That's right, and he does go to Germany. There's a doctor there, but anyway, there's a whole thing in the movie. They depict, as usual, of course, the kind of Nazi-like mentalities of people who, you know, deterred him from this and everything else. But my point is that they're really creating a whole, as you say, an identity surrounding this, where these kinds of stories are becoming the new, like, hero examples and mythologies, yes, almost to a certain extent, to these people, right? And I think also because of the fact that we are so devoid of our own mythology and stories, people who are attracted to these kinds of things, they actually get a need fulfilled to a certain extent by attaching themselves to these kinds of things. So it's a very interesting situation, because I think it's evident of how little, basically, of our own kind of mythologies and stories that we have in our own time today.
That's a great point on people feeling an urge and a need to play the hero, and that's now the hero story arc. The old Bildungsroman, the growth of the hero is now, you know, instead of growing up to be a man and slaying the dragon, it's growing up to be a woman. I don't know.
And slaying the dragon, right?
The other thing I'd point out, too, that's a little bit more bizarro about Weimarica compared to Weimar is that, you know, Weimar Germany was a, 95%, 99% white land. And they didn't really have that. There was the touch of the exotic, because I remember reading, I think it was a book on kind of how jazz bands toured Europe in the interwar periods. And they made, they went there, and their monies, especially in Germany, stretched much further. But they went there and they played. And I remember there was like Josephine Baker did like a review, and she was a total communist, but she did a review where she would do like this jungle dance in Paris and I think Berlin as well. And it was just so wild and so crazy and so exotic, but she was kind of the one who would just go and do her review. Whereas in Weimarica, there's the added element of, I mean, it's a, you know, supposed melting pot of, you know, all different ethnicities, races, religions. And so you see these really bizarro fetishisms that cross all lines and both genders. And somebody sent me a link and they said, you have to read up on these people. And what it was BDSM people and how they might approach it if your partner is from another race. Like, you know, are you kind of worried? And there was this story where this guy said, and it was a white guy and he had a black girlfriend. And he said, oh, I have, you know, we have no problem with it. And you know what? We subvert it. And sometimes she pretends to be my slave girl. and they called it race play. And really? And I said to myself, I said, so they're going to pretend they're subverting it. But and he showed a picture of the two of them on their forum, and she's in a cute young black woman, and he's a decent looking, you know, 30, looked like he was early 30s white guy. And I thought to myself, they're not subverting it by dressing up and pretending to do that. They're actually just kind of openly going, this is really the subtext of our entire relationship.
Right.
And we're going to put it out here. Like, yeah. Yes, you're black, and yes, you're from, say, a lower socioeconomic group, but you're pretty enough that me, the white guy, I'm going to approve of you and have sex with you. And I mean, it was bizarro to hear that. And there were other people who chimed in about, yeah, you know, my girlfriend's Asian and blah, blah, blah. And she likes to, you know, have somebody take a paddle to her feet. And I'm like, wait, what? And he's like, so sometimes I have her dress up like a, you know, like my China doll. And I'm like, are you kidding me? But, you know, there's that extra fetishism that goes on. And, you know, then that goes from the folks who are on the edge, like those folks who engage in race play, but then just other folks who, you know, will have a fetish one way or the other, or just even peculiarities one way or the other.
Obviously, the circumstances were a bit different in Germany, obviously. War, and then, of course, an outcome of that, a reaction, of course, to Weimar Germany. And who knows, frankly, where things will go in America, you know, in terms of a reaction to all of this. But let's talk a bit about just kind of how we ended up in the position that we are right now, and where you think that this actually is going. Because just as you said, I mean, they need to push the envelope, right? It's almost they get a kind of a high of the destruction of so-called conservative society, yeah, right? And continue to breaking taboos and boundaries and all this kind of stuff. And it's almost, as you said as well, I think is a correct observation, that it's almost like eventually that process of breaking, breaking apart society or functioning things, that becomes kind of a high in itself, right? So that they're continuously looking for the next thing. Where do we go? What's the next area? So what do you think? What is this going to develop into if they can just go continue like this?
I'm sorry to have focused more on the sexual part, but you are absolutely right that, and I would say this about Germany. Germany faced far more hardships with a devastating war in the Great War, to lose it, to basically have their identity of being, you know, like having such martial prowess, and then to lose and not even have a foreign soldier step on their soil. The stab in the back myth that was out there. They also went through a couple pushes, hyperinflation, and their entire old order was swept away. And if I kind of pin the start of this in America is basically what America went through in the 60s with its own cultural revolution, and basically wiping away the old WASP order. And if you look at a lot of changes that happened in America at the 60s, whether it was, you know, in late 60s, early 70s, loosening up divorce laws, abortion became legal. You know, you had things there, and generally the pill. So generally there were things, if you look at all socioeconomic indicators, they start getting bad there in the late 60s and early 70s. And it's just now that instead of, oh, shucks, it happened, and it's a bit of a, you know, a divorce is a tragedy, now divorces get celebrated. You know, people have a divorce party, and they get a cake, and they, you know, throw their wedding ring in a little trash bag. It's, you know, it's things like that. Weimar Germany eventually collapsed because, oh, nobody had the will to make the changes that they were going to do. They had another financial shock. And eventually they said, please, you know, the high end, the high and the big money on the right gave in and said, yeah, we'll take a chance with the Nazis. Also had a pitch where they had a very populist message. And they would change their message to which audience they were portraying. But it was a very populist message that would look at a lot of the things that were going on in Weimar Germany that were in the cities and would say, this filth must end, and this is a sign of our decay. With what's going on in America, you know, people always want to make the Trump-Hitler comparisons. That's he is nowhere near a Hitler figure. The thing that I'd say that you'll see is he's not going to do anything socially, or no figure could do anything socially. I think that America will, with what's going on social, culturally, sexually, you're going to see people push further. They're going to those frontiers that I mentioned earlier about just dipping their toes with bestiality and incest and pedophilia, they'll push to modify laws. And you'll probably see it where, especially if they suck in more immigration from the third world, you'll probably see them go, okay, we did gay marriage. Maybe polygamy should be legal.
Right. Yep.
And that'll be a next step. And
I know they're through, sorry to interrupt, Ryan, but they will be also through, think about the situation, of course, with Muslims, for example, or something like that, right? It would be through that avenue, perhaps. We can't suppress these cultures, obviously. We need to tolerate what they're doing, right? So let's do it.
Yep. And they'll end up, I can see the Supreme Court argument would be it's freedom of religion. They'll say, you can't make laws that abridge my rights, you know, to exercise my religion. And they'll say that. And then you'll see polygamy come that route. And I think what they've been doing the last couple of years is they've been kind of testing things with the bestiality, with incest, with polygamy. I think that they've been throwing things out there just to see how bad is the pushback. And then they kind of know what the next avenue will be. And they'll push for that. The other thing is they just did a report where STDs in America were not at an all-time high. And I think it was like chlamydia was at, or gonorrhea was at like an insane rate compared to just say 10 years ago.
Really?
And if you look at it, they said that there's different things that they can point to that as Tinder adoption, as Grindr adoption, you know, all the sex apps, as all those apps for, you know, dating kind of spread, you could see the rise in STDs. One problem that might happen is I can see it getting worse and people will, STDs will spread more. But if you get antibiotic resistant STDs, that might cause the entire ball to kind of slow down. And if not slow down, it might cause it to stop. But if they keep importing people from the third world, we can be honest, you know, they're peasant values. They don't have the future time orientation. These people already have higher rates of STDs compared to, say, you know, natives of the West. It'll get worse, and if the antibiotics stop working, you could see it blow up there.
Right, like a mass die-off or infertility or something like that.
Yeah, it'd probably be infertility, and you know, and I know that like Salon or Slate.com will start running articles, you know, what my gonorrhea did to me, you know, like, or when I became sterile from chlamydia, it taught me a lesson. Like, you can just see them doing that.
Of course.
But like that's, and those are the thought. The other thing that's going on to the left, I don't know what it's like in Europe, but the other thing that's going on the left in America is that whites on the left, and you can see this with the Bernie Sanders Hillary Clinton battle. Sanders basically was representing white liberals and progressives. Clinton had all the minorities locked down, and then the very high elites. That Sanders crowd lost out, and as immigration continues, and as white liberals don't have as many children, whites will become a smaller force within the American left. So it's going to be interesting what happens with, you know, with their thought leaders, or where money is spent for health, or who's writing what article to push, you know, what thing. You know, some of these pet causes, I mean, you can look at it like the way blacks and Hispanics feel about gays or other odd sex things. They don't have that same open-mindedness that white liberals do. So, you know, it'll be interesting with how that progresses over the next 8 to 10 years as the American left gets more beige.
Yeah, and I have to say, I think a lot of those whites, too, they will actually take refuge in the right, in the alternative right, in the NRX, you know, and branch out into things when they slowly start realizing what this actually means. What do you think?
Yeah, there's a possibility. Somebody told me a few months ago, they said, watch, the left will become the close-minded but economically socialist party, and the right will become the much more libertarian and open-minded culturally party, but all white. And it was like, oh, okay, I can almost see that. I mean, it'll be interesting. Who knows if this election is just one weird thing, and
right.
Who knows with who will win and with exactly how many people get amnestied if Clinton does win. So it'll be interesting if it holds together.
Yeah, it's very interesting times indeed. Now, obviously, earlier we were kind of alluding to a very advanced level to a certain extent of social engineering going on here. And some of the questions that I've had about this is, you know, what's the point of this? And what are some of the driving factors in this? I mean, it's obvious that it's an intentional erosion of you know, European cultural values, Western civilization. It's basically anything that comes out of, you know, European people's achievements, that needs to be removed and broken down. I mean, I saw a discussion the other day of some black students down in South Africa that were talking about how science itself is a imperialist, you know, Eurocentric kind of idea, and they were talking about kind of almost in the context that Newton like invented gravity, and therefore it came out of the mind of a white man, and therefore it's kind of wrong. You know, it's hilarious, you know, but it's like,
yeah, I saw that.
Oh, you saw that one? Yeah, isn't that funny?
That was great, because it's like, well, you know, we can come up with new things of gravity. It's like, no, gravity is gonna have the same pull on everybody on planet Earth. You know, relax.
We'll see. They'll try to change it, right? They'll invent some anti-gravity thing just to please these students, you know.
Yeah. Tap into some ancient Egyptian "we was kings."
Exactly. Hotep. Yep, that's right. They will do it. No, but back to the main point. There, what do you think is driving this? I mean, is it, you know, we have a faction, of course, of self-hatred within a large faction of white population, but it feels like most of those people have kind of just, they've just been propagandized into that position, and they do it because they want to signal to other what good people they are, right?
Yeah, that is a great point. I mean, there are the folks who are, okay, you know, there's the Machiavellian crowd, and the Machiavellian crowd is, okay, if we flood in enough people from another country, they'll be dependent upon our party to stay here. Therefore, we'll have clients, you know, we'll have voters. So there's the Machiavellian crowd that goes, if we can suck in voters, we'll be in power. There are the true blue, you know, pathologically altruistic, or, you know, the true believers who want to convert and want to show how, you know, they want a virtue signal. They want to show how open-minded they are. There's that crowd as well. And then there's another sliver of whites who are like, you know, white, they get white guilted and they get, you know, shamed, and they don't want to be considered a racist, so they just kind of go along with it. I mean, I think the end result is that the current regime, the current system, just wants to make it so that it's impossible for any economic power to then tap into a middle or a giant enough voting block to then stop the game as it is now. And the way I put it is, it's the way the economies are now in the West is that they're all dependent upon FIRE, which is finance, insurance, and real estate. And the FIRE economy also feeds into the academic industry, because they provide all the loans and all the funding to keep it going. So you've got basically those paper industries have linked up with the systems that are now, and because the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency, as long as the U.S. dollar has reserve currency and is militarily has the guns to back it up, so to speak, you know, as long as their Navy and as long as their Air Force can make sure everybody's afraid of them, the U.S. dollar can keep it going. They can keep printing. They can keep shuffling their dollars off. You know, the EU with the euro can keep gliding through, and they can stay in power because they'll always be able to tack on more debt, send out more handouts, pay off more people that they need. They can keep that going. And that's why if you take a look at like who's the top of our economic pyramid, it's almost all financial types. You know, there's the IT people, but like it's almost all financial and real estate figures.
Yeah, of course.
But I think that they just want to have that where they want a Brazil, if you will, a Brazil right underneath them.
Yeah.
And they'll be in a nice South Korea or Japan with enough distance between the two.
Let's talk about that in a moment, but back to your financial point as well, which is, you know, many people they've been waiting for the collapse for years now, for decades in some cases. It was meant to come, right? It was, and a part of me fears that, you know, because many people that have, you know, kind of our stance on things, if you will, they're you know, been waiting for a collapse because they see that as a moment of opportunity to a certain extent. Like, almost like, oh, the worse it gets, the better it's going to get for us, which is, you know, well, it's not true to a certain extent because the worse it gets, the worse it gets. But I understand this idea of jumping on an opportunity and making more people see, et cetera. But my fear has been, what if that doesn't come, right? What if they just continue to pump in and rake money and print money and just rake up debt and we just won't happen, right?
That's a fear, but my argument against that is this. The system that they put in place at the end of World War II, the Bretton Woods system, nearly collapsed, or actually it did collapse, for the exact same reason. America was printing, as were EU countries. Actually, your Sweden had the 30 golden years, as they called it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. They all had the 30 golden years when oil was cheap and the U.S. was pumping dollars towards them. But the U.S. also completely overdid it. And LBJ's guns and butter, and when he put in all the new Great Society programs, they basically shoved, you know, they shoved food into the system or into the beast. And it the French got caught onto it earlier. De Gaulle caught onto it earlier, and they started demanding for their gold. And then that's what forced the gold crisis. And it wasn't just, say, France and European countries going, look, we want our gold. It was also all the oil producers. And the oil producers said, hey, wait a second, you're paying us off in these dollars. We can't get the proper gold. We're getting gypped on this. And that's really the whole thing behind the oil embargo in 73. They used the war between Israel and Egypt, they used that as an excuse, but it was really about negotiating how much money they were going to be getting. And they did not trust the dollars because Nixon had closed the gold window. And then it took Nixon and Kissinger creating the petrodollar system. And it wasn't just their creation, but they had to create the petrodollar system where they'd say to Saudi Arabia, we will protect you. You know, you make sure you only accept U.S. dollars for all your oil sales. Because at the time, Saudi Arabia was considering just doing sales in the different currencies, the mark, the dollar, the yen. But then when Nixon and Kissinger arranged it for the dollar, that started the process because they were like, okay, we're the biggest producer. If we do it, other people will do it. And that's true because the Shah did it in Iran. You know, everybody else kind of hooked on and they created the petrodollar system. That's what kept it in gear. And the other piece to it was Paul Volcker at the Fed. He basically jacked up interest rates and he had to get the U.S. federal government to remove the old anti-usury laws so he could jack up interest rates high enough. But he jacked up interest rates high enough that he basically destroyed inflation in the system. By destroying inflation in the U.S. dollar, it made everybody go, okay, thank God, my dollars will be worth, you know, a dollar next year. They're not going to be, you know, worth 72 cents next year. That got everybody to believe in the dollar again. And that started the whole debt expansion that we saw starting in the 80s. And we've been doing a debt boom for, you know, 35 years. As the petrodollar system has basically died or it's dying, and who's to say if they'll be able to keep printing money, the U.S. is not the only bidder for raw materials anymore. You have China. You have actually all of Asia that now has manufacturing and full economies there. They can bid on resources. You know, you have people who have hordes of U.S. dollars out there, and they're going to want to make sure they're getting their money's worth. And that's where I think you're going to see them eventually call the bluff on the U.S. and say, you have $20 trillion in debt. How the heck am I going to get repaid?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that's just, I mean, it's increasing. I mean, wonder what another, you know, 4 years of an Obama policy through Hillary would do to this. I mean, hopefully Trump can get in and remedy it. But frankly, I don't know. How do you remedy $19, $20 trillion, you know?
You don't. And, you know, I saw this on, I don't know if you know the site, mpc.com.
Yeah, I recognize it. Tell us a bit about it.
It's a posting forum. And a lot of the term conservative came from that. But, you know, those guys, they had a thread recently about Social Security, and I didn't know this. Social Security in America had it's going to go bankrupt and everybody's benefits are going to drop 25% in 2041. That's what I had heard for years. And I had heard that it had been moved up, but I thought it was like maybe 2035. It actually got moved up, so it's 2029. And if America has another recession in the next couple of years, the numbers will get even worse. So you'll get to the point where America, the American government's going to look at each other and go, okay, in 2024, it'll suddenly become an election issue. In 2024, Social Security is going to hit a certain number, and we're going to have to reduce benefits by 25, 30%. Now, that's millions upon millions of people who depend on Social Security. And it's not just the old age. It's the old age. It's disabled. It's people who are on supplemental income. Once you get – and this is where America's ethnic splits hurt.
Yeah.
Once you get it where it's not just young versus old, it's young black versus young white, young Hispanic, old white. Once you get all those things, you're going to have people start going, you know, does my mom eat cat food so that Shaniqua can have her eighth kid? No.
Right.
And that's where that's where we are worse off than Weimar Germany was. You know, Weimarica being that weird melting pot, it ends up resembling the Austro-Hungarian Empire more than Weimar Germany before the Great War.
Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting point there. But you're seeing there is an inevitable collapse at the end of this, as far as you're concerned.
I think that the neoliberalism, the Washington consensus will collapse. I do think so.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, I want to talk a bit more about this in the second segment. We have a few more minutes here, but tell us a bit about the, you know, you're running the show through Social Matter. I think that's part of the Hestia Society. Just tell us a bit about that.
Hestia Society is a group of fellows that kind of coalesced or solidified from the neo-reactionary crowd. And for your listeners who don't know, neo-reaction, I don't want to say it's a movement. It's an idea, and it's an idea that, you know, democracy, egalitarianism, these are false gods. And there's got to be another way. And there are countless other folks who we can stand on the shoulders of who wrote about political theory and how to organize a society, how to have an orderly society, and how to something that we can look back and then plan for the future. I would say that with New Reaction, Social Matter is kind of the mouthpiece or the flagship site for it. But with New Reaction, it's a focus on, you know, hierarchy and order. And what we live in now is a chaotic world of insecure power and nobody being held accountable for anything. So New Reaction is trying to figure out political system, political theory for our current world, taking bits from the past, but figuring something so that we can create order in this world and skip a dark age, if you will, kind of find a way to wield an Excalibur to cut through the crap that's all around us and find a way out as this neoliberal order collapses.
So you're trying to cheat your way out of the consequences of our bad behavior.
No,
I'm just joking with you, but yeah, no, I understand. I understand.
It's, for your listeners who know of the alt-right, there are things that I say the biggest difference is the alt-right, I think, still believes that you can vote and figure out a way to fix things through the vote, whereas Neo-Reaction does not believe voting will solve anything. And alt-right's a little bit more populist, whereas Neo-Reaction's focused more on kind of like, as I said, you know, political theory and forging a sword for an elite, you know, for a proper space that somebody as our elite are going to be quarreling, if not already quarreling now, will be quarreling in the near future. We want to create a space where they can take a look at a different way to approach political and social problems and fix them. Whereas I believe the alt-right is more of an identity politics thing and is like, hey, we can just show up at the ballot box and we can just kick some butt and start implementing policies.
Yeah, let's talk a bit more about the differences when we come back here in a little bit. But obviously the website hestiasociety.org is a good place to go. You have socialmatter.net, and yeah, that's where your show is hosted through. Any other websites you want to give out, or maybe some personal accounts for people who want to get in touch with you or connect with you?
You know, the Future Primeval, I can send you that. I can send you a message with the actual link. The Future Primeval is a very good theory website if somebody's interested in neo-reaction. And especially if somebody's a disillusioned, you know, if maybe you're a centrist who's a little bit disillusioned by what's going on, that's a good site for you. Socialmatter.net. I would always say Nick Land's website, xenosystems.net. That's a good one. You know, and Nick Land and Mencius Moldbug are, you know, the two big originators for neo-reaction and the Dark Enlightenment, if you will.
Right. All right. Very good. We'll have some of these links up on the site, folks. We're going to just take a short break here, and then we're going to return with Ryan Laundry and much more discussing NRX, alt-right, and, of course, some of the things that are going on and how we turn things around. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Jawohl, mein Schatz, verlange dann alles von mir. Ich schenke dir alles dafür. Erst trink mit mir ein bisschen Alkohol, mein Schatz. Sei lieb und lad mich ein. Hab ich erst einen Schwips, so einen ganzen kleinen Schwips, dann sag auch ich nicht nein.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are just going to take a short break right here, and then we'll continue with the second hour together with Ryan Laundry. This is the Members Hour. As you might know, if you're a regular listener, we are 100% listener supported, and we are 100% independent. So make sure you get a membership with us if you haven't before. This is an excellent time to support what we do, as we're just about to expand in our live coverage and get more people involved. As a member, you get access to all our archive radio shows, both hours of the broadcast, but also all our videos, films, and weekend live shows, Weekend Warrior. We have 16 archive live shows so far that you can watch on demand, stream, or download. And with an active membership, you can watch when we do the live show and chat with other members. It's only €6 per month. That is $6.50 in American US dollars. We have subs from 3 months up to 2 years available. This includes a 3 month recurring subscription option. RedIceMembers.com is the website for our members. We're also overhauling the site as we speak. In the next hour with Ryan, we shift gears to discuss the invasion of Europe. We consider the effect that this is having on the indigenous people of Europe. Ryan explains how reading about hundreds of migrants being moved into a small Swedish town of only 100 inhabitants reminds him of a medieval king garrison his army in a nearby town. And unfortunately, the comparison is apt because our elite is colonizing us with a new population. We discuss France, which Ryan, citing the rich history of French national pride and revolution, believes will be the first country in Europe to revolt against their ruling establishment. The Members Hour also covers the rise of the alt-right, Trump, and the future of America. So don't miss it. It's a good second hour. Also, future shows coming up. We have John Lash and Chris DeLamo, to name a few. But we'll be back right now. Second hour is the Members Hour. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting what we do.